And joining us next here on WICC, the voice of Connecticut right here on Newsline, is Amanda Werkle. Does that name ring a bell at all? Maybe you've read about her in some of the local papers lately. She is a Connecticut woman who is in search of a living liver donor. Amanda Werkle is with us live on Newsline. I'm so glad that we were able to get in touch and to get the word out about this. Amanda, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and many thanks for having me on to share my story and to also help share my knowledge of living liver donation. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. Yeah, I read your story. I saw a clip from a television story about it, too. First of all, I do want to get into your diagnosis and your search, but tell us a little bit about yourself. You describe yourself as a wife and a daughter and a sister.
I am, and an auntie. I've got a beautiful, loving family and an amazing husband, mother, and friend base that I am truly blessed and convinced I would not be here today without. I'm a Fairfield native. I've lived in Fairfield County my entire life, and I work and live here, as do my husband. We were raised here, and we love it here. So, my roots are certainly in Southern Connecticut.
Right here in Connecticut, yes. And you're only 39 years old. That is so young to get sick like this. Tell us a little bit, take us back
sure.
to before even January of 2023, before your diagnosis. How were you starting to feel? What signs were you getting? What symptoms were you showing that made you know that there was something wrong?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my symptoms really started around October of November of 2022, actually. I was feeling very tired, very fatigued, lethargic, just general tiredness, loss of appetite, slight hair loss, minor things at the time that I was able to, sort of attribute to my workload or stress from my job. And it was easy to kind of brush off, I think, as a few of us tend to do, and say, I just need some sleep. I'll get better tomorrow. And that tomorrow never really came for me. Mm. So finally I hit a pinnacle really December of 2022 when my husband looked at me and said, you don't look good. I think it's time. So I went to my doctor. My doctor ran some standard blood tests, easy stuff that's done typically at your physicals, which I also wasn't great about. So if you're listening, people, go out there and please follow up with your doctors and get your physicals. But
yeah, good advice. Good advice.
Yeah, it's so easy. And so many of us are so scared. I wish I had done it sooner. So I had some blood work done and it came back that a lot of my blood levels were very off. They told me to get to the hospital immediately. I went to a local hospital and then was subsequently rushed to Yale where I was in a coma for a week starting in January.
Oh my goodness. In a coma.
Yeah.
And
that was I'm sorry. That was
no. Go ahead.
Basically, my body had hit its limit, right? So all of my organs started to shut down. My kidneys shut down. My liver shut down, and my lungs began to shut down as well. It was only a matter of time for the remaining. Again, spent a week in a coma at Yale, and many, many thanks to the team over there. They literally saved my life. A week later, I came out of it and was diagnosed with end-stage liver disease.
End-stage liver disease. Amanda, what does that mean?
Yeah, so what it means, so the coolest thing that I'd like to share, if I could, is that the liver is the only organ in the human body that it regenerates itself. So most people who have any type of minor liver damage, whether it's excessive drinking or appetite, certain diets, choices, that your liver regenerates once you give it a break, right? For me, what that means is my liver is beyond repair. It's reached a point where it can no longer regenerate itself. And so for that, I am looking for a living donor to help replace that portion that is beyond repair and to allow me to go on living a healthy, normal life as a young adult and hopefully grow old.
Yeah, Amanda, if I can just jump in, that had to be just absolutely devastating. I mean, let alone waking up from being in a coma for a week and then to learn that you have end-stage liver disease. Were you able to get any clarity, any answers on how it got to that point, why your liver, I guess, I don't know if this is the wrong way to sum it up, but essentially just gave out? Do you know why? Did the doctors know why?
Yeah, so it's kind of a very in-depth story, and that relates a lot to my personal medical history. But I will say that I've had some previous surgeries in the past that affected the sort of the plumbing of my internal system.
Okay.
And that led to more of an impact of what I took on either through eating or drinking that affected my liver in an adverse way.
Okay. Well, you summed that up beautifully. That helps. That helps us understand. Okay.
Yep. So it was a side effect. It was also a side effect of past medical surgeries and other things, and undiagnosed hereditary issues that I didn't know I had. So it was sort of an amalgamation and a perfect storm of things that came together to affect my liver the way that it did. And that leaves me where I am today, which is looking for my unicorn, so to speak.
Right.
At least that's what I call it, because that's what it feels like I'm looking for.
Right. We are back on Newsline with Amanda Werkel, a Fairfield native, a Connecticut woman, just 39 years old, in search of a living liver donor. And Amanda, thank you very much for staying with us through the break. You're working with Yale New Haven Hospital, correct? Is that where a person needs to go if they are potentially a donor?
Yes, I am working with the amazing physicians and specialists at Yale, specifically in the transplant center. Anybody who is interested really in more information on living donation in general can go to the link to my page specifically. And then if they scroll down to the bottom of the page, there is a separate link that leads to the Yale website where they can review any pertinent questions. There's a lot of information there, as well as a form to show interest in donation specifically for me. And that website is www.thedonorapp.com/AmandaWerkel. That's the DonorApp.com. /AmandaWerkle.
Okay, I'm writing that down as you're saying it. I think that's how I think that's how I tracked you down. But
yeah.
We're going to put this on our podcast, and we're going to share this with more of our listeners, and we'll make sure to give out that way to reach you. You touched on this earlier. Chances of a match, not so great. Is that true?
No. Yeah. So the interesting thing about your liver is that while it processes all of the toxins and flushes out a lot of the bad stuff that you take in, right? It also grows subjective to your body. So the size of your liver is quite different than the size of the person sitting next to you. So while I have a giant friend base of people who would love to be my potential donor, unfortunately, less than 10% of of the entire base is going to be a potential match for me, simply because of the size and weight specifications that pertain to me. My donor has to be of equal size or weight or thereabouts. They also have to be in general good health. We have to have matching blood types or compatible blood types, and compatible tissue types. So there are a few major check marks that live there that make the ability to find somebody that much more difficult.
Did you say an age range? Because I thought I read somewhere 18 to 60, or does that matter?
Yes, it's 18 to, I believe, 55.
55, okay. All right. And again, if anybody goes on the information that you've been providing, they should be able to learn more about this. I heard you quoted as saying it really takes a community here to accomplish this, for you to get your donor. How so? Explain.
I mean, this is a perfect example, right, how you're helping me today. Not only has my community helped me restore my physical health to kind of be a sustainable day-to-day health for now, the search for finding my donor is taken an army of people helping me. I can't do it alone. I can't do any part of this alone. And for that, I'm casting a wide net of help and of potential assistance for me to find my living donor. If I could, I did want to mention something very, very cool about the living liver donation specifically that I think a lot of people don't know.
Yes, please.
I mentioned earlier that it's the only organ in the body that regenerates itself. Anybody who would potentially be my donor would regenerate the portion that they donated to me in 4 to 6 weeks' time. So they have the opportunity to not only help save my life, they would literally regrow their liver back to its original state like nothing happened in 6 weeks.
That's incredible. I was going to ask you about that when you said that, and that is unusual. That is rare. And that would seem to be, I guess a motivator, right? If you check all those other boxes that you say, a compatible blood and tissue type, that age range in good health, 18 to 55, similar weight and height. Also, I guess the number of people in need of a liver donor in Connecticut, 100, you are among those many people who need it. But as you say, Amanda, you're getting the word out, right? And I don't know what more you can do, I suppose, right? Other than to speak to people like me and hope that people go to the website that you mentioned. And is there anything else that you're working on to get the word out?
Yes, I have a few things coming down the line. I can't mention quite yet, but look out for me. I'm out there. And I'm happy to talk to anyone about this at any time. You can find me on social media as well.
Okay.
Yale, I do want to mention as well that Yale does an amazing job at vetting any potential donors. So even if you think, oh, I'm too old, or, oh, I haven't been to the doctor, I'm probably not a potential candidate, but you're interested, fill out the form and have a discussion with the amazing donor advocates over there. Let them decide that you're not an applicable donor. You'd be surprised how much you learn at a part of this process, and a lot of information is provided on Yale's website, specifically in the transplant portion of the site. So, just educating yourself, as with everything in life, allows you to know more and gives everybody, and then share that knowledge. Share my story. You never know what's going to stick.
All right. And Amanda, I'm going to just repeat that information you gave us, thedonorapp.com/AmandaWerkle. And as I say, we'll put this up on our podcast today. And when you can break that news that you can't break just yet, I ask you, Amanda, to please let us know here at Newsline. We would love to have you back on the show. And of course, we are rooting for you. Thank you so much for your time today. Do take care.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
Amanda Werkle right here on WICC, the voice of Connecticut. And we have some developing news today from Campaign 24. And we have a guest waiting on the line, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him. Professor, I should say, Dr. Bilal Sekou with the University of Hartford. And just before we begin our conversation, I'd just like to set it up with this story that's been making a lot of headlines about a former top aide to Donald Trump speaking out about Trump. And let's take a listen to this report, and then we'll check in with the professor.
Donald Trump's ex-chief of staff, John Kelly, is speaking out to the New York Times with his strongest words yet against the former president, warning he would govern like a dictator. Kelly was asked whether he believes Trump is a fascist.
He's certainly an authoritarian, admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure.
The retired general was also asked about previous reports that Trump complimented Hitler.
He commented more than once that, you know, that Hitler did some good things, too. First of all, you should never say that. But if you knew what Hitler was all about from the beginning to the end, everything he did was in support of his racist, fascist life, you know, philosophy, so that nothing he did, you could argue, was good. It was certainly not done for the right reason.
Kelly also responded to the former president's recent comments about using the military against domestic opponents.
But we have some sick people, radical left lunatics, and I think they're the and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military.
Kelly said Trump was repeatedly told by advisors not to use the military on Americans.
Originally, the conversation would be, you know, Mr. President, that's outside your authority, or, that's a routine use. You really don't want to do that inside the United States. But now that he's talking about it as, I'm going to do it, is again, it's disturbing.
A Trump campaign spokesperson dismissed the interview and told the Times Kelly had beclowned himself. And back in August, the former president said this about Kelly.
Guys like John Kelly are one of the dumbest people I've ever met. A bully, but a weak bully.
All right. Nicole Killian there from over at CBS headquarters setting us up for our conversation. And by the way, Kamala Harris spoke just a matter of moments ago about Kelly's statement, saying that in a second term for Donald Trump, there would be no guardrail like John Kelly. Joining us live on Newsline is Dr. Bilal Sekou, an associate professor of political science, Hillyer College at the University of Hartford. Professor, thank you for sticking around during that report. So much to talk about, but I guess I did want to start with John Kelly's comments. And what I wonder, Professor, does that change anybody's mind? In other words, if you're somebody who's on the fence, you haven't figured out who you want to vote for, if you hear something like that, do you care? Does it make an impact?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, and thanks for the invitation to be on the show.
Great to have you here.
Thanks a lot. I think that's the real question. Will this really matter? I mean, you know, a couple of things are already in motion that this won't matter for, is that millions of people have already cast early votes who this might have been a bit of information. It may have changed how they voted, but those votes are in right now. I think the other thing, it depends on what the information environment you are a part of, whether you actually hear about this report or any of the other reports from like General Milley and others who have made similar kinds of statements. I think what's really powerful about this is that this is his chief of staff, and this is no ordinary person. I mean, this is essentially the gatekeeper at the White House. They oversee the president's schedule. They are the ones who allow people to see the president. They talk to the president on a daily basis. And so this is someone who is very familiar with Donald Trump when he was president, and had many conversations with him, far more than we could have probably ever imagined. And so, you know, this really is damning in terms of what he has, you know, said about Donald Trump, especially, you know, suggesting that he is fascist. Claims have been made fascist to the core by others. And so, you know, this, again, what impact this has, it's not altogether clear. One of the things about Donald Trump's support is that he has a ceiling, and that ceiling has been immovable in many ways. You know, he has said things and done things that other candidates simply would not have been able to do and still been considered, you know, for the office of the presidency. So it's not altogether clear whether this will really matter to people who are really strong supporters of Donald Trump. Now, the question about people who are still deciding, and there are lots of people out there who are still deciding in the sense that, you know, they're, you know, in the millions probably. But most people who are voting this election cycle have already decided. So the real question will be for those undecided people, those people who are on the fence, those people who are uncomfortable with him at the top of the ticket, who are Republicans and still have to vote between now and November or vote on Election Day. This potentially could have an effect on how they think about the race.
Right. And, you know, you make such an important point that, you know, some people, if they were inclined to vote for Trump, they might not have even really been following the news about John Kelly. Right. Because we tend to, as a nation these days, listen to the news outlets that reinforce our inherent beliefs. Right. So they might not be, you know, looking at the CNN headlines, you know, with Harris's reaction and such. So by all accounts, Professor, this is a tight race and we are getting down to it here. What, 13 days? Right. You know, and the other thing that everybody's been saying is, well, it depends on the undecideds. And yet, you know, just going around, and it seems like people you bump into have very strong opinions. That they're, where are these undecideds, I guess, is what I'm asking. Who are they? Who are these people?
I mean, there are a lot of people. I always say to my friends, you know, I consume a lot of news. A lot of people that I talk to consume a lot of news, but that's not every American. And so there are lots of people out there who really don't watch the news all that much. They find it depressing. They, you know, hate the constant bickering that you might see, especially on some of the cable news shows with analysts on both sides arguing with each other. And again, they tune it out. And, you know, fortunately, some of them will tune in as we get closer to Election Day and try to make their decision. And again, it really depends on what information bubble that they will sort of enter in order to get information about both of these candidates. And so from that standpoint, this is going to be a tight race. It's been a tight race. It will probably turn out that, you know, it'll be in the thousands of votes in different states that will really decide whether some of these swing states will go either for Trump or go for Harris. And even if, you know, what we've seen, you know, the Republicans have not won the majority vote except one time since, I believe, 1988 or so. What that means is that you're likely to have a scenario where Donald Trump will lose probably the popular vote, but may be in a position to win the presidency, depending on how those swing states go.
Right.
And who those undecided voters are and who they actually make that decision to vote for may make a difference in Michigan and Pennsylvania, Arizona and Wisconsin.
Right. But, you know, you finally answered the question that I'd been mulling over, you know, back to who are these undecideds? That makes a whole lot of sense. They are not news junkies like you and me who are following this rather breathlessly. Let's talk a little bit more about the battlegrounds. You said, yeah, it's going to come down to these states. Lot of campaigning in Pennsylvania, Trump also a lot of campaigning in North Carolina. Of the last few days, Kamala Harris has been really focusing on the Midwest. What, Professor, can potentially tip the vote in a battleground state?
Well, certainly information like we've just heard in the last couple of days could be that bit of information that finally tips. I think as people pay more attention, they hear about things like the Arnold Palmer comments, or they hear about, you know, other comments about going after enemies. That may be, you know, enough that people think that this is not something we want to do again, and they may want to go with Harris, even though they don't agree with her on every particular issue, but they think that she could be the best person going forward. At the same time, there are a lot of people who may tune in and say that they like this. They think that going after immigrants who are here in the country or undocumented is something that they feel like is important to do. I mean, there are auto workers in Michigan who are upset about EVs, for example, and the emphasis on EVs, and feel like it's costing jobs for people in the automobile industry. Those are people who will go against what the UAW, for example, endorsement of Harris, and they'll go against that and vote, and you know, for Trump. And so it really depends on how people will sort of collect this information over the next 13 days and the way in which they decipher it and what they think is the best path forward. I mean, inflation has hit people really hard in the country. You know, and for some people, getting the price of eggs down and getting the price of gas down, you know, to them is a higher priority than potentially someone who would persecute their enemies and bring a lot of, you know, chaos back to the White House, like if he's able to follow through on the things that he's talked about.
Right. It sure can boil down to pocketbook issues, or it's the economy, stupid, as everybody loves to say. And we are back on WICC talking about Campaign 24 here on Newsline. And we are lucky enough, easy for me to say, to have as a guest Dr. Bilal Sekou, who is an associate professor of political science, Hillier College over at the University of Hartford. I'm so glad we connected, and I have so many other questions. I thought this was so interesting recently. I'm sure you caught it. Former President Obama, not his last speech, but the one before that, when he chided African-American men for perhaps not supporting Kamala Harris, saying, "I don't want you to have any excuses about not voting for her. You shouldn't want to not vote for her because she's a woman." I was really intrigued by that. Have you noticed any slippage when it comes to the Democratic Party and being able to count on the vote from the African-American community?
I think if you look at the long-term trend, right, it's been trending down. It isn't just Kamala Harris. It's something that we saw also with Hillary Clinton as well, and to some extent even with Joe Biden. The numbers that Barack Obama were able to achieve in 2008 and 2012 were historic. And I think, you know, when you look at the base, the core base of the Democratic Party, Black voters are, you know, a part of that core base. And essentially at the national level, it's difficult to imagine Democrats winning without robust turnout by African Americans. And so this possibility of you know, losing support among African-American men, I think, and also Latino men as well, I think is potentially damaging to Kamala Harris. Certainly, I think, you know, there are some issues of sexism that are part of this. But I think at the same time, you know, it's really important. I've listened to people who push back a little bit about the way in which Obama has talked about this issue within the, you know, about Black men and their support for Kamala Harris and chiding them the way, you know, as you described. But I think at the same time, you know, the Democrats certainly understand that this is a core part of their base, and winning is just not possible without that turnout. And so thinking about those battleground states, essentially you need robust turnout and Pittsburgh and also in Philadelphia. You need significant amounts of turnout in the city of Detroit and Michigan. Without that, the Democrats don't have a chance winning those states. And so I think getting out there on the campaign trail and talking to people about, you know, Harris, talking about the Democratic Party's policies is a good thing for Democrats to do. Donald Trump has been able to make some inroads, you know, there. I think, you know, certainly when we think about, you know, his candidacy and, you know, issues around masculinity and issues around the sort of changing status of men in our society, especially as women move forward the way they should have been able to move forward in this society, that's threatening to a number of people. And if you are less educated, less skilled, and find yourself competing with, you know, immigrants who are coming into the U.S. for jobs and opportunities, then I think, you know, someone like Donald Trump and his message of, you know, removing illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants from the United States can resonate with you.
Right. You mentioned the word masculinity and a different demographic, if you will, the bro vote. Right. There's been so much talk about that and how Donald Trump might appeal to that group. And I believe he is going to go on the Joe Rogan program. You've also seen Kamala Harris give some interviews that in other election cycles, you might not have seen her trying to court that vote. And also, interestingly, you know, I listened to her interview on Howard Stern and, you know, going for some of the younger guys who tune into Howard. And, you know, so it's fascinating to me, Professor, how in this political campaign season, and they've been really targeting those sort of niche media outlets to try to get a very, very specific slice of the vote.
Yeah. And in my mind, you know, someone who, you know, is a political scientist, this is a good thing. I mean, these are the things that politicians should do. You know, again, with, you know, because we have an electoral college, it creates a situation where only a handful of states really become competitive and states that people place a great deal of emphasis. There's a way now to sort of micro focus the way in which you campaign with each other. We're collecting so much data and information about people. And so, you know, trying to pull out, you know, those pockets of voters, those small groups of voters, finding them, identifying them, and trying to get them to the polls, you know, in a tight contest like this could be the difference between winning and losing. Donald Trump in 2016 had some success, especially among young white males. Young white males who were not regular voters turned out for him in 2016. He lost some of that support in 2020. And certainly a lot of his emphasis and a lot, if you listen to the tone of his rhetoric, it's really directed at that audience and really trying to speak to that audience. And so, you know, both campaigns have really focused on pulling to the polls those groups of people and those very narrow sort of in that narrow range. And again, it really can matter in a race that is this tight.
Right. And what do you make of I have a zillion more questions for you, but I think I only have time for a couple of more. So I'm going to have to ask you to come back. But what do you make of all the people heading out to vote early? We the lines in Connecticut were so long on the first day that the governor decided he had to bail. He didn't have time to wait on the line, which is just so crazy. But it's good. You know, people love performing their civic duty, as it were. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I love the idea that Connecticut has adopted early voting. Another hat I've worn in the past, I was chair of the board for Common Cause in Connecticut. And back in 2012, I participated in a press conference with Governor Malloy and Secretary Denise Merrill, in which we made the case for a number of election reforms. Among them was no excuse absentee voting, as well as early voting, same day voter registration. And over, you know, this, you know, slightly more than a decade, we've seen many of those reforms in place. I had an opportunity to vote on Monday. Unfortunately, I wasn't the first. I was the third person in Vernon who actually voted.
Okay.
I felt like I needed to do this because I worked to make this happen, along with a lot of other people to see it happen. People in line were excited. I mean, I mentioned to people the role I played, and folks said to me, "Thank you for what you've done." So Connecticut has joined the 21st century. We ran into problems enacting this kind of reform, primarily because you need to change the Constitution. You have to go to the voters.
Right.
If this had been simply a legislative effort, then we probably would have had early voting a long time ago, as well as no-excuse absentee voting. But fortunately, you know, voters now have an opportunity to weigh in. And we, as I said, we joined the 21st century, and now we are voting early like millions and millions of Americans all across the country.
We sure are. Professor, can't thank you enough. What a lovely conversation with you. Dr. Bilal Sekou, Associate Professor of Political Science over at the University of Hartford. Hope to have you back on the show real soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next here on Newsline, the voice of Connecticut, we are lucky enough to have George Vesey with us, a longtime New York Times sports columnist, a six-time New York State Sports Writer of the Year winner, an author of not just sports books, but other books. Wow, his resume is just too long to get into here. But George, it is so good to be back on the radio with you.
Oh, and vice versa. I'm so happy to hear that you're doing what you do so well, which is interviewing people. Nothing I like better than when I was driving around New York City in the area and hearing you make sense out of science and business and politics and medicine. So I want to see if you can make any sense out of what I've got to say.
What a great compliment. Thank you so much. Well, I'll see what I can do here.
You could get things out of people that, who really knew what they were talking about, and you would answer. You ask good questions.
So. Oh, thank you. Well, I know you know what you're talking about. And before we get into, you know, the big World Series, have to ask you about Fernando Valenzuela. Probably our listeners have heard this on the CBS News updates. He died at a young age of 63, a legendary Dodgers pitcher. What was so special about him?
Well, he was the natural. He popped up at, you know, 19 or 20 out of western Mexico, and the Dodgers didn't know what they had with him. And he showed up at the end of the 1980 season, and he pitched very well. And not only that, but he could hit. And he was just a very basic, natural player. And the next year, he was even better. I know that he was like 20 years old at the time. And my friend Bob Welch, who was a star pitcher with the Dodgers in those years in the early 80s, Bob would just marvel at, you know, Freddie. That's what they called him, Fernando Freddie. And look at Freddie. He can even hit. He gets that screwball, and he gets his arms way over. His eyes go up to the heavens, and then he pitches. I mean, he really was a one of a kind. It didn't last all that long. He didn't have that greater career ongoing. But when you look and see the number of complete games that he pitched in the early 80s, I think it was like 110 or something like that. He completed games. Nobody does that anymore. But Freddie was one of a kind.
And speaking of numbers, I don't know that there's any statistic on this, but he drew great numbers of Latino fans to the baseball stadium.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but I think it was Dusty Baker, who was, you know, one of the great Dodgers when he was playing, said that the thing about Fernando was it wasn't just Mexican flags or Mexican T-shirts or whatever, that anybody from Central or North America, in Mexico's case, that people would go and Guatemalans were there and Salvadorans and Costa Ricans. And so watching Freddie pitch, that he was one of a kind. So it was broader than that. I think he actually changed the demographics of it. I know that I was listening to your colleague Howie Rose calling the Mets games the other night, mm-hmm. from Dodger Stadium, and Howie was saying how when you used to go to Dodger Stadium in the 70s, the first years, the fans were calm, peaceful. They'd leave in the seventh inning. They were laid back in the California thing. But I do think that not that Mexican fans are necessarily any different, but they certainly brought a lot of energy and wanting to be there and cheer their homeboy. And I really do think that the louder noise, the louder energy in Dodger Stadium can be traced back to Fernando showing up.
Right. And Fernando mania. Okay, George, I'm glad I got your thoughts on that. You know, I knew you were coming in today to talk about the series, but had to ask you about that. Okay, so the Dodgers opening the series in L.A. Versus the Yankees on Friday night. First of all, before we get there, for our Mets fans out there, what happened? My son is he follows a lot of sports. And I said, well, what happened to the Mets? And he said, it's easy, Mom. The Dodgers were better.
Well, he's got the good point of view. The Dodgers really are better, and they figured to be better all year. The Mets had a magic year coming back from a terrible start. And I think that some of us gave up. I mean, I know we have a little family group that gets together online and talks about the games because we can get them in our where people live. And we were so surprised when the Mets came back and started to play well in the end of May, June, whenever it was that they began to win. And they played above their heads, above anything that you could have expected from them. So I think your son has the right idea. In the long run, the Dodgers, I mean, having that big Ohtani at the top of the lineup and so many good players, even without great pitching, they were the better team, and they showed it. But at the end of the day, I know I'm exhausted from staying up late for some of those games out on the West Coast the Midwest. The Mets played in the last month of the season, and I'm just tired. I suppose I'll have to get some energy back to watch the World Series. But I think for a Met fan, it really will be an after effect of, okay, so we gave everything we had, and the Mets gave everything they had, and thanked them for it. And there's no hard feelings. They did well.
Now, I know you write pieces on your website, and recently you wrote about your personal feelings about the Dodgers and why, George, you cannot hate them.
Oh, exactly. Except, you know, this is a team, the uniforms, the colors, the bright red numbers, in some cases the bright blue. I saw the first game I saw, and this will date me, of course, was 1946. I think I was like 7 years old, and went to Dodger, to the Ebbets Field in Brooklyn with my father. And it was a year before Jackie Robinson got there, but there were players like Carl Furillo and Pee Wee Reese, and I think a kid named Hodges was around, and Snyder, or certainly they were on their way up. And so you knew that something was happening. And that was the team that I loved until they left, and I felt let down by it, as a lot of Brooklyn Dodger fans did, of course. And for years, I tried to hate the Dodgers and hate the O'Malley family, and how could they do this? But the first time I went out there with the Mets, I was traveling for it when I worked for Newsday. I made a trip, and I think it was 1964 was the first time I was in Dodger Stadium. And the mountains off in the north, and you'd see the purple mountains and the nice evening sky. And you'd say, so who wouldn't move to a new place that clearly, you know, Southern California is just a wonderful place to be. And they knew what they were doing. They pushed the poor Mexican squatters out of Chavez Ravine, as Roy Cooter did in the great songs about Chavez Ravine. But even at that, even if the local people got pushed out and the Dodgers left Brooklyn, you can understand why they did it. And then because I did a book with Bob Welch about his how he conquered alcoholism while he was playing for the Dodgers, I certainly spent a lot of time with those Dodgers in the early 80s, you know, Valenzuela and Dusty Baker and good people like that, Rick Sutcliffe. And I felt like I was part – I knew some of those guys had come, the trainers and the people who worked at the ballpark, they'd come from Brooklyn. They were New Yorkers out there in this strange land. So I just got Al Campanis, the general manager, who, you know, had some problems saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, but just a wonderful guy. And he was a Brooklyn Dodger farmhand. So I felt like the Brooklyn Dodgers had made the transformation. I at that point, I never could hate them anymore. They did what they had to do.
Okay, so George, maybe you don't hate them. Who are you rooting for? And I guess maybe the better question is, in this, I guess they're calling it the Goliath versus Goliath matchup. Who do you think is going to take it, the Yanks or the Dodgers?
Well, let's put it this way. I think that the networks, and I'm not a big fan of network baseball. I'd much rather listen to the local broadcasters because they know the team better and they're more plugged in. But you could see from the commercials between the innings how they were plugging Otani versus Aaron Judge, and how all these Giants, the Giant for the Yankees, the Giant for the Dodgers, that they were hoping for this matchup. And if that's what they think, if that's what would be good for their ratings, for people to be watching this show, I can understand that. Who do I think will win? Honestly, I'm not sure that I care. I suspect that the way I suffered as a child and back in the 40s, watching the Dodgers lose to the Yankees in the World Series whenever they played. I mean, it's one of the great rivalries in baseball, the Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers, and even when they moved out. I have a feeling that my Dodger, my dollar Dodger fandom is going to kick in. But I can't hate the Yankees anymore because they're not the same team. It's not the same world. And frankly, I think Aaron Judge is one of the finest players and people that I've ever seen. I can't root against him. He's just terrific. So I'm going to sit back and see if I can stay up late for the games on the West Coast.
That'll be the goal. I'm pretty conflicted. I don't know who to root for. I covered the Yankees ticker tape parade. I think it was in 95, and I jumped on that bandwagon because it was just so much fun to be there and to cover that great team. But, hey, George, we'd love to have you back on Newsline another time to talk anything sports or any of the many other topics that you've covered in your books over the years. New York Times legendary. Can I say legendary? I want to. George Vesey.
Old guy still going.
No, who sounds as young as ever. George, what an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being with me here on Newsline.
Always a pleasure. Look forward to hearing you again. Thanks.
All right. George Vesey there on WICC, the voice of Connecticut.